Okay, folks, you should have your Bibles once again. Open to Romans chapter 13 and verse 9. Romans chapter 13 and verse 9. And what we're going to do is pick up with our last lesson where we've been talking about after the godly thinking of beginning to receive the instruction of judgment, owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. And then in verse 9, he's going to list these five laws, five of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. And if there be any other commandment, is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Our last lesson, we talked a lot about how that godly love and charity is like that guidance system that our Father has installed in us, so that when we make judgments, we are able to make them based upon this powerful guidance system that is the way in which He makes them. And that those things we have to confidently realize are being done in righteousness, not being done in some morality way that is defined and shaped and molded by the course of this world. But even though the word may be the same, like selflessness, it is defined and described and actually generated by our Father's words living in us as we have received that from our edification as sons in the sonship curriculum. And so what we're looking at is the first of these five commandments, and the first one here is, thou shalt not commit adultery. That is the absolute opposite or the antithesis of selflessness. And when we last ended, we talked about how that just as the law, the Ten Commandments, were like this wellhead issue with underlying issues, sub-issues underneath it that were just as unrighteous and just as unholy and would lead to that ultimate expression of breaking one of the Ten Commandments as Christ dealt with that. We examined that from time ago back in the Gospel accounts. That's kind of the way that's going to help you out a little bit in thinking about, all right, when it says thou shalt not commit adultery, it may or may not be, I hate that expression, by the way, may or may not, well, which is it? But I oftentimes say things where I look back and say, well, that's stupid. But it may not be immediately apparent to you why selflessness is the antithesis of that. Or when you match this whole list up, you may not be able to see immediately. That's why the little wellhead issue is important. Some of the five features of godly love, you may have been spending time with this, with your Bible and with those five features, and maybe match them up differently. Or you see that they could match up with one or other of the five commandments. Or even maybe you could say, well, this one matches up with two or three of them, one or more. But what I'm after is that if my understanding is correct, they really are set in stark contrast. And it's having to think a little more deeply about it and looking for something specific about each of those five features. That's why I gave you that handout, which was this chart here, that kind of not only gave you a little glimpse of the scripture of the godly aspect of each one of these features of God they love, but also kind of gave you a comment that maybe would spark, okay, I remember when we were there and we talked about that, and that there's something specific about selflessness and about kindness and about tenderheartedness and meekness and benevolent goodness that makes it so that it really does stand as the antithesis to one of these five commandments in the very order that they're in. And so we're after a feature of godly love that's being driven at that matches up with a particular commandment listed. Each command is actually the epitome or the wellhead of what comes from the unrighteousness in the heart that's the exact opposite of that particular feature. So with that kind of in mind, when you think about adultery being the violation of the marriage bed, it's a sexual relationship with a married person having sex with someone else, whether they're married or not, but it's a married person having sexual relations with another. With that in mind, What's the underlying, what would you have to say is, if you look at the sub or underlying motivation, what is the underlying motivation of committing adultery? Being unfaithful, right? That's good. Lust, yeah, that's definitely one. What? Yeah, yeah. And I expected to get several issues there and everything, but that's good, because you can say lust, you can say whatever, your participation level isn't quite. But when you think about those things and those underlying issues, I think what Lisa said, it's almost like you if you spend time with those things, and you think about lust being one of the things that jumps to mind right away, but when you're married, thou shalt not commit adultery. Adultery is described in the realm of someone who is married. In other words, it's kind of like when I did Joshua, like I told you, when I did Joshua and Jessica's wedding, she just seemed to be so thrilled to be married that and everybody knew everybody there, but she was like, "This is my husband. Have you met my husband? This is my husband. This is my husband." And, you know, I can't remember, some cartoon I think I saw when I was a kid, the little chicken girl got married, and she goes, "I got me a man." but that's it, that's the point, isn't it? You've got yours, right? Whether you were tempted or whether you were, it was lust and all of these kind of sub-issues factor into it. But when it comes to the actual boiling of it down, it is the epitome of selfishness. It's the opposite of selflessness. Because it is anybody who commits adultery, at their core, it could be because of lust or because of, they could justify it in all kinds of situations of life, and well, it was this, it was that, it was just a one-time thing, it was the pressure of the situation, this and that and the other thing. But when it came down to the actual committing of the act, it was absolutely selfish on your part. It was you had to be full of self-centeredness, self-importance, self-absorption. That's what lusting is. That's what setting aside a vow and setting aside fidelity and setting aside your troth, which is in my old ceremonies. Adultery is you've got a man, you've got a spouse that you belong to, and the only thing that would motivate you to go out and have a sexual relationship with someone who isn't your spouse has to do with something at the core of the fact that you are selfish to the extreme, based upon selfish, fleshly desires. And so it's really pretty easy to see that if you take the issue of adultery and all of the things that could surround it and all of the various reasons for maybe why it's committed and all of that kind of thing, my understanding is lying is at its root is selfishness to the extreme. And it's also pretty easy to see that committing adultery is therefore the very antithesis of being selfless. It's the antithesis of the characteristic of godly love that's supposed to be established within you. If you're married and you have your spouse and you belong to that spouse and that spouse belongs to you, it's just real simple. You don't belong to that other spouse, and that other spouse doesn't belong to you. Or even if it's not a spouse, they don't belong to me. She does. And if I have a relationship, a sexual relationship with someone else, then at the core of my being, what I have been, you can say I've been unfaithful, I've been lustful, I've been all of these things, but I have been at the core of the issue, selfish to the extreme. And what is absolutely critical is that you understand that and appreciate this is not merely, selflessness is not merely the opposite of adultery. Or that the only issue here that you're learning is, well, God's teaching me how not to commit adultery. That's not what this is. That's not what this is teaching you. The issue is, look, son, you're going to make judgmental decisions. You've got now enough godly love and charity developed within you so that your natural concern now is for others' spiritual welfare. So you owe all men an expression of godly love. And remember that when you go to do that and you go to make those judgments, that you can have confidence to make those judgments based upon a guidance system that I installed in you. That guidance system has got five features to it now that is going to enable you to make judgments the way I do. And fear not, those judgments are going to be righteous in my sight. And here's how you know. Selflessness is the exact opposite of committing adultery, of thou shalt not commit adultery. And what is critical here isn't just to see that they're opposites. The critical issue is that you have this negative commandment, right? Thou shalt not, whatever, commit adultery. You have this negative commandment that is consistent with the very righteousness of God Himself. And what you have to understand and appreciate is that your godly love keeps you from doing that. And it takes into consideration all of the underlying subtype issues that we've talked about of the heart and how you choose and how you determine to judge and act in your conduct and behavior upon those issues of your heart. Because that this is a wellhead issue, and it accounts for a whole range of issues underlying it. It's just incredible how powerful love is, because of how wide-ranging it can adapt to. Well, the truth of the matter is, when it just comes to this commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, no one operating upon the basis of godly selfless love would ever commit adultery, with or without a law, with or without a commandment. You wouldn't need a commandment. If you're operating upon the basis of godly selfless love, you would never commit adultery, period. Because it would be the opposite of that. It would be selfless. It would be selfish, not selfless. And your selfless love just simply would not allow you to do that. So you wouldn't do that with or without the commandment. The point is, and the point in each one of these five is, that your godly love has now developed to the point where you can live righteously. And that's the issue. The issue is that this law is fulfilled in righteousness by the godly love that's generated within you. And therefore, it's going to regulate your conduct and your behavior in righteousness. This is really amazing how God has been able to establish a way of regulating one's conduct and behavior in this dispensation of grace without putting you under the law. You can live righteously and godly in this world with godly love as the principal factor in making your judgments. Godly love is the guidance system and the principal factor in making your judgments. So therefore, the righteousness of the law is fulfilled in godly selflessness. Does that make sense? You see that? That's the way these things are designed to be set up. Okay, good. How about the next one? Thou shalt not kill. Well, there's not a whole lot of explanation needs to be made here. That's pretty straightforward. But setting aside the issue of capital punishment, or going to war or defending yourself from criminals and things along those lines. I don't know. I don't think I need to say that to this bunch, but you never know. So I will say it. And when I say setting aside the issue of capital punishment, going to war and such things like that, a lot of people will take up the Bible, especially the King James Bible, and they'll read, "Thou shalt not kill," and that mean they take that to mean, well, you can't even kill an ant. You can't kill. You shouldn't kill a cow, which is unthinkable to me. That's food. I don't know who it was that said they put a salad, you know. Well, I'm just going to get a salad. That's what my food eats. But it spawns a whole host of problems because they see thou shalt not kill and can only think of kill in one particular way, and therefore the whole idea is that if you really were a Bible believer, if you really were a Christian, if you were really reflecting God, then you would not kill anybody, and that would include it, putting anybody to death, capital punishment. Of course, the Bible comes along and says, well, there's different, kill can be used in different ways. Obviously, God instituted capital punishment over in Genesis, and so that's not what this is obviously talking about. Both in the law, like I said, the very law of the law above that demanded the death penalty for committing adultery. So God wouldn't come along and contradict his own law. And so, you know, you get all kinds of things like people not wanting to go to war or at least being what they call a conscientious objector, which means I'll go, but I won't pick up a weapon. By the way, just so that for your information, I've said this probably before, there is at least one, I think more, but one that I know of, incident of a soldier receiving the Congressional Medal of Honor, and he was a conscientious objector. One of the most famous Medal of Honor recipients of all started out as a conscientious objector and then went in as a non-combatant, and that was Sergeant York from World War I, Alvin York. But he had this struggle with this same thing. Desmond Doss in World War II received the Medal of Honor. He was a conscientious objector. He was a medic. So but setting all of that aside, that's not what the command, thou shalt not kill, is talking about. It's talking about committing murder. And both in the Hebrew term ratsak and the Greek term phonuo both mean to kill in the sense of committing murder. Committing murder. Well, obviously, committing murder is rather unkind. Obviously, this is the antithesis of kindness or loving kindness. The motivation to commit murder can come from a lot of things. I mean, it's one of the most widely broadcast episodes on TV is about law, order, murders, and all of these kinds of things. It's a whole film genre. But the motivation to commit murder can come from such things as hatred, disdain, cruelty, envy, jealousy, rage, a whole bunch of things. But again, what you're after is to kind of think your way through that and to be able to say, but what we're after is what is it that makes it the antithesis of kindness? Well, killing someone is actually, and this is where I don't have two boards and I can't put two things up at once, but you've got that little chart that I gave you, the five features, and really what you've got in this grossest and most extreme form of unkindness is when you're, if you were to murder somebody, that would be the absolute antithesis of abhorring that which is evil. You're actually committing that which is evil. The decision to kill or to murder someone is a decision to do evil rather than abhorring that which is evil and cleaving to that which is good. And so what you've actually got there is you've got that issue of thou shalt not kill being that's the far end of the spectrum of unkind behavior. If you were to take unkind behavior to its furthest degree of unkindness, it would lead to killing or end in killing. So therefore, you've got with the characteristic of the godly kindness operating in you, you don't have to be commanded, thou shalt not kill. Because you're going to abhor that which is evil. You're going to cleave to that which is good. And with loving kindness operating, you don't have to be told, don't murder somebody. You don't have to be commanded not to kill, because a properly educated son, if God's love is truly effectually working within you, your godly love would actually come along and prohibit you from ever murdering, from ever committing murder. You don't have to be told. Now, listen to this carefully, and this applies for all of them. It doesn't mean that you could ever come along and not volitionally override everything you know. No matter how far you get, God never comes along and takes your volitional decision-making decider and just flips it to autopilot. And what I'm saying is, a son at any moment can come along and just determine on his own to make a free volitional choice to just go a different direction. So what I'm saying is, these things don't mean that you couldn't override and make a free will choice, but as long as you're under that divine guidance system, and it's kind of like being able to fly. I don't know if we haven't got any pilots in here, but it's like when you first learn to fly, they call you VFR, you're visually flight rated. So you can get in your little airplane, you can go up and fly on a clear day. And you can't fly at night, and you can't fly in weather, you can't fly in clouds. All you can do is fly when it's a nice, clear, blue day, because everything you're flying by is sight. But eventually, you'll learn to trust your gauges. And if you've flown, and I remember the first time it ever happened to me, when you fly on a cloudy day and that jet goes up into that cloud bank, it's amazing how quick you lose your sense of direction. You don't know if you're climbing, if you're falling, or any of these things, or if you're turning or what. You're in a cloud bank, you can't see a thing. Those pilots have got to be IFR. They've got to be instrument flight rated. They've got to be able to forget about anything that their eye sees and focus entirely upon their instruments. And their instruments is what's going to tell them where they really are. And that's what this godly love and charity does. It provides that ability so that you can fly by not by what you imagine or what your surroundings dictate to you, but by exactly what your Father has taught you. And therefore, under this divine guidance system of godly love and charity, you won't. Like I say, that doesn't mean that a pilot can't just take the stick and just roll the plane over or nose it right into the ground. But as long as he flies by that guidance system, as long as you're under the control and under the divine guidance system of godly love and charity, you won't commit murder. Because your loving kindness abhors that which is evil. Your loving kindness won't permit you to do that. And what I'm trying to get you to see is how powerful that is. Just like your godly selflessness won't allow you to commit adultery. Which, by the way, makes a whole lot of sense out of having somebody who's got at least some spiritual maturity in them before you get married. It'd be a big plus. But their godly kindness, loving kindness, will not allow them to go out and commit some heinous act of evil against someone. You now, especially like when you're talking about members of the body in here, you got that body thinking going. And maybe we didn't talk about that much up there in selflessness, but there's even application for that. And here you've got that living union bond of brotherly love now that's been generated within you. You want, as a son, you want for that person their spiritual welfare. You don't want to take their life. Well, all I'm after, and not belaboring all of this, but once again, and all of these are going to be like this, but what you've got is righteousness. The righteousness of the law is fulfilled. The righteousness of thou shalt not kill is fulfilled in kindness. Any questions? Make sense? Okay. Well, let's go for one more. For this, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. Anybody want to hazard a guess what the Greek word is for stealing? I just thought maybe somebody... Yep. Or as Barney would say, a kleptomaniac. You've heard of a kleptomaniac? Comes from the Greek word klepto, and that's the word steal here. Thou shalt not steal. Well, this is an interesting one. When somebody steals something, and the reason I find this one interesting, and even in some ways fascinating, is because of how many things can be justified as okay to steal. Usually when something is stolen, I've had this happen to me. And I remember when I was a boy growing up, and you hear these stories all the time, but I mean this is literally true. We didn't lock our doors. And then in the 70s, late 70s and everything, Mom and Dad thought it might be a good idea. Not that there was any crime. And you live in a town of 300 people. The only crime being done was by me and my cohorts, basically, at Halloween. But you would, for some reason, things got a little bit more testy. So Mom and Dad, I always thought this was strange. They decided they'd lock the front door. But they never locked the back door. Our back door was never locked. I don't even know if we had a key for it. But we always locked the front door. As if a robber wouldn't think, oh, I can't get in the front door, so I'm pretty sure the back door's locked too. I'm just going to go away. Or not go to the back door first, where it was dark. The backside of our house was pitch black. So I grew up in an environment where I never really had anything stolen from me. And it wasn't until I got to Chicago that I experienced that. And I had several items that were stolen from me by a fellow student where I was in college. They caught the guy. I got back the most important possession he took. I got back, which was a mouthpiece. It was a clarinet mouthpiece, but it was crystal. It's made of crystal. And Cindy had given it to me as a gift. There was only one company in the world that made those crystal mouthpieces called O'Brien, and I had one. And I got that back. He also stole a tape recorder, which I didn't get back. I think he pawned it. And he stole some of my music books, which was really weird. It was like, what? I didn't really care. It's like, you know, Gregorian chants. Well, you can have it. I don't want that. But I can remember how mad I was. I was so angry that someone would steal from me. Because I wouldn't do that to them. And it just enraged me that somebody would do that. And when you start thinking about the concept of stealing, you start getting, oftentimes you get justifications for it. Well, maybe it was because I needed money and this kind of thing. And this is where you've got to let your mind go when you start thinking about stealing and realize what its antithesis is. What is it at the underlying issue of it? When something is stolen, or you steal something, more often than not, in fact, the vast majority of the time, it's done secretly. Now, I know there's exceptions to all of this stuff, but the majority of the time, stealing is done secretly, and it's done dishonestly, right? You don't steal something in plain view, usually. Usually you steal something secretly when no one else is watching. My stuff got stolen because I was employed by the school as a instrument repairman. And I had my stuff in the instrument repair room, and I stepped out for a moment because somebody wanted me to check an instrument, and when I came back, my stuff was gone. So it was done secretly. It was done deceptively and dishonestly. Well, if you've got that stuff going on, that tells you there is something wrong going on in a person's heart. And what we need to do is to get down to that, like I said, with killing and like I said, with committing adultery. What is the underlying motivation for stealing? And this one ought to be fun. Now try to loosen up some. Class is almost over. What is the underlying motivation to steal something?
Not having it.
That's good. That's good because this is going to lead us where we want to go. You don't have it, they do. Being greedy? Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. Your brother's mind works differently, doesn't it? Just to see if you can do it. Yeah. It's kind of like politicians, right?
Lazy. Quick way to get something.
Yeah, that's true. Lazy, quick way to get something. You don't have to work for it.
Kind of the opposite of
giving. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's my takeaway from the whole day right there. It's kind of the opposite of giving. This is good. This is where I wanted the discussion to go. Can you imagine a good, I'm using this word relatively, a good scenario for stealing?
Robin Hood.
Yeah. Now come on, some of you Les Mis people.
Stealing something that feeds your family.
Jean Valjean. He stole bread because why? Well, was it his sister's family or somebody? Yeah, was hungry. Yeah. See, when you start thinking about stealing, that's why I said stealing has got kind of all of these, it's got this kind of wide berth for, you know, stealing things that you could almost justify in a way. That's why you gotta take some time to think about this because That's not getting it down to it, boiling it down to it, something essential about it, something specific about it. Whether you're lazy and you just want to cut corners, or whether you're greedy and you just want to take something because or you're jealous and you want it to be yours, or any of these things. But even in a good, so-called good scenario, where you know my family's destitute and starving and I saw that this lady had five pies laid out cooling on her, and she's surely isn't going to need all five pies. I can at least take one of them and feed my family. And therefore, they're in a jury in the world that would convict me for stealing that pie. Maybe not. Probably not. But that's not the point. My understanding is that either way, whether it's a scenario of stealing diamonds out of a jewelry store or stealing your wallet in a crowd, or whether it's stealing for some kind of so-called good scenario. Either way, there's something that takes place in your mind, whether you're stealing that loaf of bread to feed your poor baby, or whether you're stealing that diamond necklace just to feed your own gratification. There's a common happening that goes on in your mind the moment you take it. What is that? And yeah, you think you need it? Yeah. Now, let me turn this one. Let's turn this. What is your thinking about the person you're stealing from? They don't get it, but that's not the core of it. Yeah. But what do you think about that person? We're getting there. We're in the tin ring. They don't matter. That's pretty well saying it. You're saying, I don't care about you. Or that at least somewhere that line gets crossed. Where you say, I know I shouldn't, I know it's just for my, I can justify it, and all these kinds of things, but the act of doing it, the actual taking of it, at that moment, it's, you've crossed a line where you say, I don't care. And that's getting down to the heart of the matter. It's either way, whether it's justified or a good or bad scenario, at the moment of the taking, this particular thought is reached or this particular line is crossed, and I'm talking about crossing a line, not the president. At the moment of stealing, even in the face of the consequences, and you would justify it as some noble act that you are willing to face all the consequences of it, whatever the consequences are, the mind, when it takes it, says, I just don't care, I'm still going to take it. And what I've just described is an aspect of hardness of heart. And that is the exact opposite of tender-heartedness. If you take all the underlying issues of the heart in connection with stealing that we've been discussing and talking about, my understanding is the whole thing can be boiled down to that one basic fundamental issue, a hard heart. You've hardened your heart. A hard-heartedness is the exact opposite of tender-heartedness, and it's complete insensitivity to others. You, in some measure or form, when you steal, you're just simply saying, I don't care, I'll take it anyway. Whether you may even say, in other situations, I wouldn't even do such a thing. All right, but still you did it. And the doing of it, you have to cross that line to say, I don't care, I'm going to take it anyway. I don't care what the circumstances or the consequences are, I'm going to take it anyway. And stealing something from someone signifies, in the loudest of terms, I don't care about your needs. Remember, again, I'm having to shift things here, but you've got your hand out there. In tender-heartedness, in stealing, you say, I don't care about your needs. In tender-heartedness, that was developed out of the use of selflessness and kindness, and it's going to display itself in conduct and behavior by distributing to the necessity of saints, by being given to hospitality. Isn't that, that's a direct opposite of stealing something. You're distributing something, not stealing. That's what you learned as a son when it came to utilizing godly tenderheartedness back in the curriculum for your sonship education. Distributing, not stealing, from the saints. And at the core of godly tenderheartedness is this godly and merciful compassion that can't overlook a necessity. A thief comes along and says, I'm not only not going to overlook the necessity, I'm going to fill my own needs, my own way. I'm going to steal from you. I don't care about your needs. A son doesn't think that way. A son doesn't act that way. Tenderheartedness cares about the needs of others. Stealing says, I don't care about the impact of taking from you. I don't care about how it impacts your family. I mean, you even see such, it drives you crazy sometimes because you see such things as like, I can remember, where was it around here during, I don't know, Christmas or something along those lines that the Marines do the Toys for Tots. Some joker came along and stole all the toys for the tots. Or you hear about somebody stealing somebody's, walker or something. I mean, some crazy stuff out there that people steal. And it's just, again, emblematic of someone coming along and saying, I don't care about taking from you. We got some guy now who's going around with a helmet, you know, stealing money at gunpoint. But that, when it comes down to that act, that's what you've actually got. The very opposite of a tender heart. A tender-hearted person would never do that. And by the way, stealing is also, and I'm not going to go into all this, but I'll let you have fun with this on your own without going into it. But you know how that all of these build on one of another? That's kind of what's going on here as well, because stealing something is also selfish and unkind. So there's a building process that's going on here as well. I imagine you could spend forever just realizing how God develops His Word in this sense and sequence thing. It's just amazing, but I just point that out. But at its core, the issue of stealing, it doesn't care about the impact upon the person, because the person doing the stealing is simply hard-hearted to it all. You steal, like I say, food for someone else, even if it's feeding your own family. However it may or may not be justified, the matter still comes down to, I don't care if you're hungry. My heart is hard toward you. At that moment, I care for me and mine than I do you and yours. And so therefore, stealing is the antithesis of tender-heartedness. And again, if godly love is effectually working within you, this divine guidance system that now is going to reflect itself in your conduct and your behavior, that is going to ultimately be expressed in this saying, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, and the work that you're going to do with your father is working no ill to your neighbor, then you have to have absolute assurance and confidence that the guidance system that you have that's going to enable that to work is going to be righteous in God's sight. And when you realize thou shalt not kill, or pardon me, thou shalt not steal, is fulfilled in righteousness by godly tender-heartedness, then you have that confidence. God's love is effectually working in you, is taught to you exactly by your Father. You don't have to be told. I say this for all five of them. You don't have to be told, don't steal. You don't have to be given a command, don't steal. Just like with adultery, you don't have to be commanded to not commit adultery if godly, loving selflessness is operational in you. And when it comes to stealing, you don't have to be given a law not to steal, because your tender heart would never allow you to take something from someone else. In fact, your tender heart wants to do the very opposite. It wants to distribute to a saint's need or necessity, not to take or steal from them. So therefore, the righteousness of the law is fulfilled in godly love being tender-hearted. Well, we're really about out of time for this morning. I'm trying to hold myself again because I'm having some of these inner ear problems and things and not go over. I think what we'll do is I'll just mention this and we'll maybe talk a little bit about it in our next lesson. But it's interesting, even though we're kind of through halfway of these five now, has it I don't know if it's dawned on you or not, but we're dealing with the law. The Mosaic Law, where the law is concerned and how we are to put our sanctified position in Christ into practice, under grace. Do you see how things have progressed? I mean, it's amazing. From the time that we were back, in fact, I'll just show you this and we'll stop. Come back, flip back to Romans 6. And like I say, I know probably one of my greatest problems, mistakes, or whatever, is drawing Romans out, being years and years and years and teaching it. But if you take out all of that and remind yourself that all the way back here when we were first introduced to our sanctified position in Christ and wanting to put that into practice properly, Romans 6:14 said, "For sin shall not have dominion over you, for you're not under the law, but under grace." But then the question came up, what then? Shall we sin because we are not under the law, but under grace? God forbid. And what I'm after there is, if you remember back then, and this is always a question people have when you start talking to them about living under grace. And one of the hot button topics you could ever get involved with many Christians is you can preach on the Ten Commandments all you want, but you cannot put your position in Christ into practice under the law. Man, people will go apoplectic. Oh, you're just going to, Pandora's box is open. You're just going to sin and sin and sin and sin. That's what gets addressed there. But not just that obvious question. Well, how then will sin be restrained? What, shall we sin now that because we are not under law but under grace? But there's also that other feature that we talked about is how in the world the law had the erroneousness of the law was, look at the law, was that the law was designed to do two things, not one. It was designed to restrain and squelch sin in my life, and it was also designed to motivate me to be able to do and produce good that God could accept. And both of those things are wrong. And Paul goes on to give a detailed analysis through the end of chapter 6 and all of chapter 7 of how wrong that is. And what you're left is, well then how do we do this? How do we live in righteousness in God's sight? And he begins by walking after the Spirit, by the adoption of sons, by the sonship curriculum. And do you see how that by the time you get here, what was said to you back here really is true? That you can fulfill the righteousness of the law under grace. And God really does give you the power to be able to do that and a way to do that where you don't have to be commanded, you don't have to be told. When he instills properly into you his mind, his godly love and charity, it fulfills the righteousness of the law without ever being under it. Well, I think we'll give it a rest there and we'll stop there for now. When we come back on Wednesday night, we'll start rounding out the rest of these. And there's still a lot in verse 9 that we need to be able to get. We're going to deal with this issue of assaying and see how that works out as a principle and all these kinds of things. So some fascinating things coming up that are going to round out this first component of receiving the instruction of judgment. But what a magnificently powerful guidance system our Father's given us to be able to make it so that we confidently can make decisions and judgments as sons and know that they are going to be righteous in his sight. Well, we'll stop right there and pick it up on Wednesday night with our heads bowed. Heavenly Father, we thank